I'm Louie-Ann Trost, and this is the session on physics, cosmology, and God. That is how I've titled it. In fact, though, it will be dealing not quite so directly with the scientific topics and God as more indirectly. We'll get into that a little bit later. Before we begin, I'd like it if you would be willing to introduce yourselves. I'll tell you just a little of my background and the reason I'm interested in this. I had some science background before I went to seminary, and throughout, I guess it was in the early 70s when I first was exposed to some of the books that were being written at that time. One of the early ones was called The Tao of Physics, which related Eastern religion and what was happening in physics. But throughout that time, I was beginning to, though I didn't have a strong background in physics itself, was beginning to be interested in finding out what was going on in physics. It sounded pretty exciting. So after seminary, I have started graduate work, and I'm now studying at Berkeley with a person who has this degree in physics, a PhD in physics, and taught for a while in that field, and also is a United Church of Christ pastor. He and many others are trying to integrate some of the findings of science with the Christian faith. So that's a little bit of my background. I really can't say exactly why the topic fascinates me so much, but I just think it's really exciting. I'm glad that you're here today, and hope that you find it as stimulating as I have. Shall we begin? How about, why don't you?
John Van Rode, fellow away.
If you'd like to, please say something else about if there's some particular reason, something in your past that that for which you have become interested in this, please share that to me.
I'm teaching ethics to adult classes in the church. And eventually you come to what is the purpose of creation? Is there a plan, is there a mastermind, or is it all accidental? This should give you at least a hint of what's going on, or has been going on, and is still going on.
Thanks.
Tom Perry from Vancouver, British Columbia. And this is something I've always been interested in since I was, I guess, in high school. Started studying physics, although I didn't do it very long.
I'm Barbara Kite, and I'm a couple of years ago, the man who wrote the Tao of Physics spoke at the Evergreen State College, and was quite interesting.
My name is Carl Johnson. I own a real estate office now, but I'm a graduate forester and work in forest management for 10 years in the state of Washington. Interested in the land and science. And
my name is Esther Kapke. I live in Everett, Washington. I'm a retired teacher, and I just spend most of my time being grandma.
I'm a Van Rooker. I live in Dubuque, Iowa. I'm just curious.
Great.
I'm Liz Nave, and I live in Springfield, Ohio, and I'm just interested.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bonnie Watts, a kindergarten teacher near Disneyland, and the title intrigued me.
I'm Linda Ray Watts. She's my roommate. We're not related. We're not. Surprise. And the title, strangely enough, intrigued me.
Steve Priest from Spokane. And I'm just interested in what science too.
I'm Ralph Miner. I'm a middle school science teacher in Seattle. We come up to these issues all the time. I teach Earth science in particular. And we talk a lot.
Gordon White, I work for Boeing, and I'm trying to square Darwin with evolution and Genesis.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we dealt more specifically with that yesterday, but we will deal a little bit with origins also today and get into cosmology.
My name is Jim Corfin. I'm from Regina. I'm studying more arts-oriented things in school, and I'm always interested in things to do with science.
I'm Jessie
from Regina too. I'm Joanne Holt, and I need to learn something about science. I mean, the social science.
Okay, well, we've got a real variety of backgrounds. Should lead us into interesting discussion. Before I begin, I will say that in 1 hour's time, we can barely get into an introduction to the materials that we could deal with, but perhaps it will be enough to whet your appetite that you might want to get into it in further depth at other times. And at the same time, I'll have to apologize for the information being fairly generalized, which maybe you may appreciate. I won't get at all into the mathematics related to the scientific theories, and we'll just barely cover the theories themselves. And I think then that our discussion, you may be more interested in relating these theories to the Christian faith. So we'll, I will plan to leave a good bit of time for the discussion. The topic, the title that I chose, Something's Afoot in the Universe, as you may hear in the Vesperstein, I'm not sure, actually is a quotation from Teilhard de Chardin, who was a paleontologist, a Jesuit priest and paleontologist, and he was referring more specifically to evolution and what he saw as going on in the universe in regard to the continuing creation that's going on in the world, that something's afoot for him meant that God and we as people are sort of working together, and that there's an energy that's continually creating new things in the universe. That was sort of what he meant by it. But I saw the connection too with what we're going to talk about today. As I hinted earlier, I think that I might say a word of caution about trying to relate too directly the idea of God and the ideas of science. I think that oftentimes that's the danger in something, a discussion of this kind, and some books that have been written, some people are saying things that try to equate God with energy or other kinds of things that I think reduce our concept of God to physical images. So I'm not going to attempt to do that, and I think that the relationships are less direct than that. And yet at the same time, I'm a great lover of nature, of the outdoors, and have studied science enough to be fascinated by the world that God has created. And I believe that somehow, in some way, God is evidenced there in the world of matter and energy. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. Some of you may have heard of the book God and the Astronomers. It's written by Robert Jastrow. It's a very short paperback. Very readable. I might recommend it. At the end, the conclusion is a bit, I thought was a bit amusing. I'm not sure how accurate it really is, but at the end of the book he comes to talking about scientists who have labored up through their endeavors at research, have labored up the like climbing a mountain, and when they reach the top, they find the theologians already sitting there. I'm not going to imply that is what we're trying to get at today, but I'm encouraging seeing some relationships between scientific theory, what science has found, and what we believe about God and the universe. Darius showed me an article earlier this week that I thought I would share with you. If anyone's interested in reading it, you would be welcome to. Darius isn't here, but I'll, I think I can pass it along. It's out of the June 13th Newsweek, this summer's Newsweek. The front cover of the magazine shows a picture of Stephen Hawking. The title, or the caption, is Master of the Universe, One Scientist's Courageous Voyage to the Frontiers of the Cosmos. I don't know if you've heard about the work of Stephen Hawking or not. Okay, many of you have. Good. He's written several books that have become very popular recently. He spoke in Berkeley a few months ago, I guess it was this spring. He gave a series of three or four lectures, and each of them were packed. He spoke in the largest auditorium on campus, and they had to open another auditorium and do an audiovisual over there for the students and the people who attended those lectures. Part of the fascination, I think, with his work is not only that it's extremely innovative and said to be on a par with the work of Einstein and other great scientists, but also I think there's a great deal of interest because of his having Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, and has been working against that handicap, has been working with fascinating scientific theories. But this article, okay, the title of the article then, fascinating one. Can you read it?
Reading God's Mind.
Right, Reading God's Mind. But this would be a good way to start off our discussion. I'm not, as I said, we won't have time to go into the details of Hawking's theories, and I'm less familiar with those than I am with some of the theories of relativity and quantum mechanics. But Hawking is trying, along with some other physicists, astrophysicists, to come up with what many of you know as grand unified theory. That is a theory that will explain everything. And the physicists actually believe, I think he actually believes that they may come up with that. There's a problem with the integration of some of the major theories of physics now. That is that relativity, which talks about the grand scale of things, and quantum mechanics, which talks about the very small scale, are not quite compatible. So that's what he's working at, and it's believed that when that theory is found, or unification for the theories is found, that we will know more about the actual origin of the universe. So that, I think, is the reason for the title, Reading God's Mind, even though the article does not refer specifically to the title. I guess I could pass that around as we're going through this, and then if any of you are interested. You've seen it? Okay. There's a second article in there on cosmology, which is related to the unified field theory. Okay. As I've said, it's going to be hard to even touch on the scientific theories, which will be the jumping off point for our discussion, but I'm going to try to do that. And then if you have questions and would like to know more about the specific theories, I'll try to answer your questions. First of all, how many of you do know something about what relativity is about? Oh, good. Okay. And we've got, I suspect there would be some of you probably know more about it than I do. I've only come into physics very recently. Well, as you know, Albert Einstein was the person who theorized both the special and general theories of relativity. Before the time of Einstein, coming off of Newtonian physics, was believed that space and time were absolutes. That is, that space and time could be measured completely separately. In Einstein, in the theory of relativity, space and time are relative to one another and dependent upon the frame of reference of the observer. In Newtonian physics, the geometry of Euclid, the geometry we all learned in school of straight lines, of absolute space, held sway. But in relativity, not Euclidean geometry no longer holds. It's another type of geometry in which space is curved. And actually, when we talk about relativity, we're not talking about space as an absolute anymore, but a continuum of space-time. That is, that space and time are so closely related, we can't really talk about one without talking about the other. The special theory of relativity then was expanded and generalized into a theory of gravity. Now the special theory, the main difference as I understand it, is that special relativity refers to a localized frame of reference, and general relativity refers to, is a theory of gravity. And then this, the best way of summarizing it that I remember comes from a textbook about it, is that space tells matter how to move. Matter tells space how to curve. So that gravity is no longer understood completely in Newtonian terms, but that there are, let's see, and you would say there are different centers of gravity, but space itself and matter in space interact with one another, and that is what leads to the gravitational force within the universe. Okay, that's very, very generalized, I realize. And I'll just throw out a few ideas that that the change in this theory about physics may lead to changes in our notions about other things, such as our, even though the theories talk about physical space-time, we then wonder what kinds of implications this has for understanding of time as we experience it. Now many people will argue that this is just, this doesn't reach the world of our experience. It's much, talks about cosmic space-time, it really doesn't have anything to do with us, but we might talk a little bit later, does this have any kinds of influence on our notions of time itself, of the relation between ideas of being and time? Does it have anything to say about the nature of God? Can we still think of God and the classic notion of God as a static being? Or do we want to emphasize more that God may be, may have something to do with the notion of becoming, that there's some kind of temporality in God's nature, that time is related to space in our physical notions, and maybe the being of God has something to do with time as well and temporal change. Okay, some of the notions that arose out of general relativity led to the discovery of the expanding universe. And on that relationship, I'm a little bit fuzzy at this time. I didn't look it up before I came here. I studied it some time back. If any of you are interested, maybe others in the group know more about it. But at any rate, we talked a little bit yesterday, and we can get into a little bit today, about the Big Bang and the expanding universe. We talked yesterday about the creation story and evolution, and the question arose, well, what about the origin? What do evolutionists say is the origin of the universe? Well, the theory of the Big Bang really arose separately from the biological theory about evolution, and the Big Bang was theorized because of evidence that the universe is expanding. Because some light rays from objects out in the universe were what's called redshifted, that scientists could tell that they were going away from us, away from the Earth. So there are several reasons for which it is believed that the universe is expanding. And that led to the notion that at one time, and then into further experiments, that at one time, at the beginning of the universe, there was a point called a singularity, and this was point of extremely, infinitely dense and hot matter energy. Okay. This leads also to questions about whether the universe is open or closed, and how and if and how it might end. So that leads us to questions relating to theology again about God's relationship to the world and to the universe in creation and eschatology, that is, the creation and at the end of things. I'll leave that open for now and get into that in a few minutes. Boy, there's so many topics amazing. Maybe this is too much. Maybe we should stop here and go at what we've got here. There's just one more major theory that I wanted to talk about. What do you think? What's your feeling? Do you want to stop and get into that now?
Get into your one more major theory, yeah. Then we'll start.
Okay. Okay. Good. Good. That is quantum mechanics, and I referred to it briefly before. And here are a lot of fascinating things to talk about in relation to our view of the human being, our view of the freedom of will, freedom and determinacy. Because it's in the theory of quantum mechanics that a lot of things were discovered about the nature of reality, that is, the physical world that physics studies, was not so certain as it was expected, as it was seen to be before. There are a couple of principles that come out of quantum mechanics that are both pretty fascinating. One is called complementarity. Okay, again, quantum mechanics deals with the very, very small. That is, if you know what atoms are, well, what quantum mechanics deals with are smaller than atoms. It's particles. And in the study of photons and electrons especially, was found that these particles behaved in a very curious way. For a long time, light was believed to be, I believe it was first believed to be a wave only, but then it was discovered that it behaves both like a wave and a particle. That is, it has properties that can be described as a wave is described and can also be described as a particle. So this then is called complementarity. It behaves as both a wave and a particle at the same time. The term quantum mechanics comes from the fact that in this theory, energy has a specific quantized. It comes in intervals. It's not just a continuum, but it's like a nickel, a 5-cent piece. It's rather than being a continuous flow, it can be is seen as having a specific quantity. Okay. Then the other principle that comes out of this theory is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, or indeterminacy. Okay. Now I'll try to unpack that. It's called Heisenberg because he was the scientist who came up with it, or who explained it, I guess. And it's called uncertainty principle because the measurement of these tiny particles leads to both, or it's complicated in that the observer affects the measurement, and in that its momentum and position cannot both be measured accurately at the same time. That is, the measuring instruments itself affect the measurement, and that the velocity can be measured with accuracy, but the greater the accuracy of the measurement of the velocity, the less the accuracy of the measurement of position, and vice versa. So that's the basic notion behind this uncertainty principle, which is also called indeterminacy. And this is where it can lead into the most interesting discussions about if we generalize from this scientific theory about matter and energy at the very, very smallest level, if we generalize from that to the macroscopic world and try to talk about how this indeterminacy, the small level, might give us analogies, and we might talk about whether we can say more than, if it can give us more than analogies for the macroscopic level of life. We'll discuss that in a minute. That's definitely an open question, but at this very small level, the particles themselves are not determined. That is, there could be what has been called alternative potentialities. That is, it could go in any of several directions, end up in any of several places, and it's only measurable by statistical probability. That is, any one particle cannot be traced, or cannot be predicted where any one particle is going to end up, and we're left then with the probability of what's going to happen to the particles. So that has implications for our what scientific theory, what science can predict. It has raised questions about, there are several ways of interpreting that result. Some have said, it's a limitation in human knowledge or human ignorance. We just don't know yet how to find that out more accurately, that is both position and velocity of these particles. And the other is that this is actually the way things work. That's that our ways of dealing with scientific knowledge are stuck with this way of explaining things in the universe. So that's a very brief overview. Those of you who've studied it before, I'm sure we'll see huge gaps in what we've covered. But I hope that stimulates thinking enough to begin to a discussion of it. Yeah, why don't we just jump into it rather than my trying to lead you?
Just a comment at first, these quantum effects, it's tempting to think of them as this great big divine joke played on physicists, because it really upsets their apple cart. It's the first effect that they've discovered that makes things less well behaved than they were before.
Right, yes.
Things are not behaving like they should be all of a sudden.
Yes, it was very upsetting to physicists at first when this came out.
They didn't want to believe it.
Right. In fact, Einstein himself didn't want to accept it.
But he never did.
Right. No. That's right. I guess he never did. And are there any questions about the material specifically before we get into it?
What did Einstein never accept?
This theory of quantum mechanics what did he say? God does not play dice. Mm-hmm. Subtle is the Lord, but not malicious. And he just thought that it had to be more ordered, that the universe just could not be that unpredictable.
His theories were very tidy, and this King Warner messed them up.
Yeah, that's right. Fascinating. Einstein's writings are really very fascinating. He wrote some philosophical stuff besides his physical theories, and in fact explained that his, and those who have written about him have found the connections between his scientific theories and his philosophy of life. It's very, really interesting. Other questions?
Well, I have very little knowledge in this field, but you mentioned the Big Bang Theory. I'm sure I've heard of at least three or four others, and none of them are necessarily opposite to God's creation. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. Those of you who were in the session yesterday can help help out here, contribute whatever you'd like. Since we did cover that in some depth yesterday, I don't want to spend the whole time on it, but it has a lot to do with the interpretation of Genesis 1, which we often see as the only creation story in the Bible, which it is not. There are lots of other accounts of creation in the scripture. Genesis 1 talks about a seven-day creation, but it also talks about sort of immediate creation. All that relates more to this discussion of evolution, but specifically in regard to the Big Bang, some theologians have attempted to draw the parallels and to use the Big Bang Theory to support the Judeo-Christian doctrine of creation. That is to say that, rather than, as some people initially were really some account of creation in the Bible, that there was a point of beginning and that this was the way God created. From the singularity, the universe began. And on the other hand, there have been those who argue against that usage. I just had discussions this past winter with a philosopher of science from Notre Dame, the person I work with in Berkeley, and the theologian at the Pacific Lutheran School about this very issue. One arguing that here is something in science that we can use to support the Christian idea of creation, of God's creation, and then the others arguing against that it can be very problematic to use a scientific theory directly support Christian belief.
The bias from the fact, of course, that if you look at the chance that this globe on which we live came into being as it is, there is a very likely chance of one in X billion possibilities that it exactly had the proper amount of elements to come into being from what we have now. If it would have been hundreds of a degree off, the whole thing would never have happened. So they come to the idea that is a mastermind behind it, whether it is personal or some power. There's another question that becomes religion, right? But there is some thinking mastermind behind what happened after, or just at the moment of they press the button and the Big Bang starts. Now the most important thing of course is if it expands and it contracts again, and it would then expand again, there's another Big Bang, there must have been also, or there might have been, before our creation, another creation where the same thing has been going on. And all the evidence has been wiped out. And now you try to find out what that was, you'll never find it.
Yeah, that's another idea. There are many different notions about the origin of the universe, and none of them at this point are proved or provable. And it is that point of beginning that the scientists are not able to answer the questions. I mean, they're still working on finding out more about, let's see, what is the figure? I think they're able to describe the laws of physics that hold at t equals 10 to the minus 35 for 35th second, which is a point with 34 zeros behind it and one. So they feel they can describe pretty accurately down to the very, almost to the very moment. There's a book out, the Moment of Creation. The first 3 minutes in which this expansion is said to believe to have begun. But beyond that point, they're not able to explain. In fact, this article in Time raises the question too, that, or raises the issue that even though they're coming close to having a lot more explanations than we've had before, science still doesn't attempt to answer the question why, which is in part what we come to in the belief about a personal creator. So that's one way of...
Mm-hmm. Well, one characterization of it I've heard is the Bible doesn't tell how these things happen, they tell us why.
Right. Yeah, that's a good way of characterizing the difference. That creation, the creation story in the Bible, is more about a relationship, between God and the world and God and the universe, between us and God, and not so much about specifics of how it happened. It doesn't really claim, at least in our world, to be a scientific account of how things happen. And we have to keep in mind that when it was written, the view of life, of the worldview, was just really different. They had no conception of science as we know it. Any others?
Is it true that scientists, if they don't see in an experiment beauty and harmony, that they throw it out and say it can't be true?
Those are a couple of the things that are looked for in scientific theories. Coherence, what's the other word that they use?
Elegance,
that's it. Yeah, I like that. So those are a couple of things they look for in postulating theories. Anything else on that cosmological point?
It would seem to me that this, the physics of the universe, ought to disturb the people who are so exercised about evolution even more, perhaps, than evolution. But they don't seem to take on physics the way they do evolutionary biology so much, or am I wrong?
That's an interesting point. You sure don't hear about it as much. It's perhaps because, at least I would guess in one, at least partially, because this level of physics isn't usually taught in the high school. Well, the Big Bang is taught in the high schools, I guess.
We talk about it in middle school.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I grew up before, I was in school before it was theory, so I'm not sure what... Well, then maybe they throw that in with evolution, but it is interesting because it does seem to raise even more questions, I think, than evolution. Perhaps it pushes us to ever expanding ideas of who God is, to have created in this way. For many people, that's problematic. I think for me, that's part of the question. How narrow does our idea of God need to be? I guess with that, I would imply that I think sometimes our ideas of God are too narrow and they need to be broader. But then again, you know, what does this say about what kind of God creates? And then it raises the question again that was raised yesterday and was given as probably one of the explanations that this stuff is problematic for people, because it removes the human being further and further from the center of the universe. And that raises issues.
The physics are a little esoteric for people, but when they think about evolution, they think about human beings descending from the apes when they object.
Mm-hmm. That is probably part of it too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the physics is a little further removed.
Mm-hmm. If you come to the point that being is becoming, then is God still omnipotent, or is he held captive in his own creation?
Is God still what?
omnipotent.
Omnipotent.
All-powerful. Or is he captive in his own creation? In other words, if he created the law of gravity, and you sit on an airplane, you're going down, and you pray that the airplane will fall up, it won't happen. Because if the law of gravity is stopped, the whole cosmos collapses. So, I mean, how... And this is a point where a lot of theologians get trouble with, of course. They say, well, then God is not that all-powerful.
Now, why
now
is
you
that?
Get close to heresy, according to the church, right?
Well, okay. Why do you say God is not all-powerful, according to that?
Because if he would, or she would, I'm sorry, we use inclusive language. If the creator or creatress would mess around with his own creation, it will collapse. There are a certain number of laws that hold the whole thing together. You cannot just take one part out of it and the building collapses. We talked this morning about earthquakes. You know, and why is an earthquake happening to innocent people? Because God created plates. Now, if you start complaining that God created plates, then God will tell you, do it better, go right ahead.
You've raised a lot of really interesting issues. One is our idea of God, and then the relation of human life to the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
In the when you talked about the plate tectonics, and that reminds me of a discussion in the Bible study the other day about chance and human suffering and God's role in things. But it's a lot to get at. Anybody want to take a stab at it? Anybody want to?
I opened a can of worms.
This isn't an answer, but it's all part of the question that arose this morning in Bible study when we were talking about this, about we're just part of the chorus, we're not the conductor.
No.
Yeah.
And, you know, things happen to trees and to people and to animals, and because all of creation keeps on evolving and changing, and things happen like volcanoes blow up and storms come along.
Right.
And we are in the way, that's all.
Yeah, that's how I've always seen it. That's a little bit weak when it comes to somebody whose child is, you know, the tragedies that happen in human life. But I think as Terry pointed out in another session as well, I think that if we can begin to take more seriously God as creator of the universe, in addition to being personally involved and concerned about each one of us, we can see our place in the world in a little bit different light, and understand and realize, know the love of God, despite the kinds of things that happen. And as you said, we just get in the way in of these natural processes. That comes back to the laws of nature that you spoke about. If we believe that God created things as they are, then God created the laws and everything the way they are. And I don't know if we really want to get into that, the relationship between natural laws and God's power, that raises all of the questions that people have about miracle stories and about God's intervention in the laws of nature. Fascinating questions. Do we want to get into that? Anybody curious about?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, like the sea opening up, the Red Sea opening, so the Israelites can get through, and the manna from heaven, and all of these stories. I mean, do they have scientific basis, or were they pure miracle?
Okay.
Does God work in us?
What? Is there another comment?
Or are they just stories?
And are stories just stories, or are they a way of telling a truth about the faith of a nation and their relationship with God and their understanding of God's faithfulness to them? I think the stories of the man in the wilderness falling from heaven, the parting of the Red or Reed Sea, the miracle stories in the New Testament have been explained in a lot of ways. Some theologians have tried to demythologize these stories. Some have interpreted them allegorically. Some have said that, you know, over the years the stories have been expanded, and what initially may have been a very natural kind of occurrence got blown up into a very fantastic story. On the other hand, I believe that a God who creates laws of nature, it's not for us to say that God could not intervene in the laws of nature. I don't know. I'm not going to say definitely that that's what happened in those cases, but I will always leave open the possibility that that's true. I think our idea of God has to be big enough to allow that.
There's still some mysteries left over.
Yeah. There are things that we can't account for, perhaps. Wolfhart Pannenberg is a theologian from Germany who I find really fascinating. And of course, this then, we haven't raised the issue of the resurrection, but that comes in here. And Pannenberg's way of dealing with the resurrection, you know, a lot of theologians of the early part of the century won't talk about the resurrection as a historical event, that it actually took place in history. And yet, that raises all kinds of questions. Well, then that passage of Paul, if Christ is not raised, our faith is vain. So does that mean if Christ is not raised symbolically? Pannenberg's way of dealing with that is a fascinating one. It's been criticized also, but I find it real interesting. And that is that he feels that the resurrection was the, I don't know if he uses this term, is what Bob Devine's advisor often says, the first instantiation of a law of physics that we don't know about yet. And that means the first instance.
We're talking about quantum physics and particles, and we're not knowing about those before, and all of a sudden we're finding these things that don't work like everything else did. All of a sudden, exactly. 1,000 years from now, we're going to look at our systems and our medicine and our techniques as primitive.
Right. So I find that a really fascinating way to view it.
We can't get away from thinking this Greek thinking that it was a fact, you know, that Christ, I mean, like a rocket belt up to heaven.
Right.
Or can we see the value of this? I mean, the disciples who went home and say it's over, and when the resurrected Christ come back, their faith is resurrected. They start believing in Christ again. The church starts somewhere along the line. You know, that I see as the master plan. Mm-hmm. But to have to believe, which to me is a mystery, you know, that they're all standing there and there goes Christ. I mean, where is the point? Where is heaven?
Yeah.
Stop about thinking the fact. See the value.
And do we have to have a cut and dried creation story? Can't we accept the biblical account of a relationship?
Yeah.
And a reason for, rather than exactly, I mean, to have faith. You don't have to have the exact, because science hasn't got there yet.
Well, can't we accept that God can do what he wants to do, when he wants to do, how he wants to do, and we're not going to understand it in this life?
Right.
Maybe you tried to make that point known to us through the book of Proverbs, too. So we talked about that a little the other day. Mm-hmm. And the mythology is also a series of questions.
Yeah, sure it is.
And the Bible is really a book of questions and a book of answers. And quantum mechanics is a set of questions. Maybe it's a joke on all of us, not just the physicists.
The biggest problem I have with the Apostle Creed is when you're supposed to say, I believe in the resurrection. So when everyone is saying that at Vespers, I mean, is everyone believing in a different thing.
That's a very interesting point. Yeah.
Very likely.
I suspect so. There may be any number of notions about what resurrection means.
A few years ago, Walter Wandering did a series called Stories in the Arms of God. You can find it in the tape library. And one of the things he did was to go through the creation story and view it as a myth. And he tried to explain the concept of a true myth.
Right.
One that expresses a truth about some eternal fact in our faith.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. I think the word myth has a lot of different meanings, and it needs to be, you need to take a good bit of time to deal with what that means.
In common language, it means something like a lie.
Right.
Yeah, doesn't true myth kind of, I mean, true and myth are opposite. How can you say true myth?
Yeah, in most people's minds, yeah, that would be the case. And that's why I didn't raise it in this context.
But a myth is really a story that's meant to explain how something happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth listening to his tapes. He also does the Norse creation myth. Uh-huh. He's quite a storyteller.
Oh yeah, he's a great storyteller. I've heard him preach.
When we go back to cosmology, can we go into that idea as Carl Sagan says, we are made of the same stuff the stars are made of?
That's a good one to get into, right? Yeah. You've probably heard of Carl Sagan's talks or that notion that the particles in our bodies, in the world all around us, have probably come from stars that exploded how many light years ago. That the matter of the universe is so expansive and is I don't know if I could use the word interchangeable,
so we could have a molecule of Moses in us or something. things don't come or go, it's all here.
Exactly.
And we die and rot and float away, and so that some of these particles are dropped back in the trees and we eat them and send somebody else. Or
yeah, exactly.
Which is mixing it all up again.
Which leads to a really interesting thought about the interconnectedness of life, of life in the universe.
I think you said something earlier about the time and reality and the little teensy-weensy particles upsetting everybody because they're not uniform like they were supposed to be. They kind of waffle. I mean, I can't express it in your terms, but
that's
sort of the idea. Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of a massive thought there.
Oh, it is. It really is. That's why it's so exciting, because it talks about our view of matter itself. You know, it's really matter and energy are so closely related in these theories that you can't really separate them anymore.
It's really not a theory that stuff's all here and it's going to be recycled. I mean, when the plant, the life cycle of a tree, I mean, it grows and dies and rots and gets taken up again, that's a fact.
Yeah.
And so what? I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with our faith.
Well, I don't think it needs to have anything, any negative effect on faith. I think that it's
just the way it is.
So interesting to me because, and science itself, I think, is exciting because it discovers all of these wild things about the universe that
accentuates or does more to prove, if you have to have the proof. Mm-hmm. Of the creation.
Or another way of putting it might be that we see the vastness and the subtlety of God, and it can either challenge our faith or enrich, or both enrich our faith. And, that's what I find it so fascinating.
I read a story where in these quantum physics and these subatomic particles, they see matter coming out of nowhere. They can't explain that culture. But they say maybe it is the creation of ex nihilo, you know, as God created without using something which was already there. Creating out of nothing. And in the experiments, they see that something is coming into the picture which doesn't belong there and shouldn't be there, but comes in. Where does it come from?
When they try to pick up these particles and these deep mines, and all of a sudden this particle is there, don't they figure it came through the earth? Or that it just,
they have no explanation.
They don't know.
Yeah, they have ways of measuring the neutrinos, which they think come through the earth and have come from stars that are exploding. And some of you may have seen the public television program about that some time ago. There are just so many other points we could pick up on. We really only touched on indeterminacy and chance and free will. We really haven't gotten into that at all. But before we close, I'd like to just refer to a couple of resources if you're interested in taking this further. One book that's become a classic in the study of faith and science is called Issues in Science and Religion. The author is Ian Barber, who is a physicist who has a background in both physics and theology, I believe from Yale. He teaches now at Carleton College. This book was written about 20 years ago, but is still very accurate and very, very quite readable. That's one.
What was the name again?
Issues in Science and Religion. I'd ordered it for the bookstore, but I don't think it's in yet. I do believe it's still in print. There are a lot of books referred to in that, books and other writings. A lot has been written over the last couple of decades, too, so if you're really interested, I'd be very happy to suggest further reading.